Chapter 23, The Spirit and Personality of the Six. We came to know that the next day, Dr. Nilkantha Suryanjathar was going away for good, and the Inspector General of Prisons was coming there. When an officer came on a round, we told him that Superintendent N.S. Jathar must see us before he leaves. He could, if he wished, call us in his office. We had to say something to him before we questioned the Inspector General of Prisons the next day. We were soon asked to meet him in the office. The villain was sitting there along with the jailer and the new superintendent, Mr. L.H. Khan. Mr. Jathar says, "Now what have you to say?" I reply, "We are going to report to the Inspector General of Prisons that our books and manuscripts have not been returned. Will you please tell us where our books are? If you have burnt them, you must give it in writing. Secondly, you are going to Jabalpur as superintendent. Why not take us with you?" To this, Mr. Jathar replies, "So far, you always said that you wanted to get rid of me. Now you ask me to take you along with me. What is the meaning of all this?" I tell him, We have gotten used to you. You have done your worst with us, and we know how to deal with you. You will now go to Jabalpur and unnecessarily harass our comrades, Bhai Nidan Singh, Pandit Jagat Ram, and Bhai Sawan Singh. They are very happy under Mr. Rajaras, the superintendent of Jabalpur prison. They have a good library, a tennis ground for games, and many other facilities. The first thing you are going to do to them is lock them up in dark cells. Pandit Jagat Ram is writing some books there in the prison. You are going to burn all those books. You have burnt all our books. You will unnecessarily torture them. They have lived happily under Mr. L.H. Khan. So if they are brought here, they will live happily." Mr. Jathar replies, "Why not make Pandit Jagat Ram the political prisoner, the superintendent of the prison?" I tell him, He is as intelligent as you are. If you can make him a superintendent, why not do so?" Mr. Jathar, a little unnerved, replied, "The books have been burnt. If you wish to institute a case against me, you can do so when you are released. What has happened already. It cannot be undone." Tears rolled down his cheeks as he said these words, which he wiped with his handkerchief. "I cannot take you with me. Tomorrow morning, you can lodge any report against me to the Inspector General. I have instructed Major H.L. Khan how you are to be treated." I tell him, "What other instructions could you have possibly given to Major H.L. Khan? Expect to torture us, as you have been doing. But I do not think he would be so foolish as to follow your instructions. Can he not use his brain?" After saying this, we came back. The next day, the Inspector General came there. He examined my history ticket, which was with me, and addressing the superintendent, he said, "You could settle this matter of registered letter yourself." The superintendent says, "The envelope was torn from one side. I did not know Gurmukhi. So if anything out of the registered letter had been lost, I could not take any responsibility for the same." The Inspector General says, "You couldn't open the letter in his presence." The superintendent replies, "If I had opened it in his presence, he would have read it at once. So I sent it back to the post office. They asked us to send the prisoner to the post office, but we expressed our inability to do so. So I wrote back to them that the letter should be sent back to the place from where it had come, and it should be sealed properly there and posted again to this place. We then brought the matter of our books to the notice of the Inspector General. The superintendent says, "I have burnt those books, and now they may order and get new ones. Yesterday, they were trying to befriend me and even asked me to take them along with me to Jabalpur." I said to the Inspector General, "You are now a witness of the fact that he has burnt our religious books. He has admitted this fact in your presence." The Inspector General says, "When you are released, you can take legal action against him." I then told him about my ironically worded talk of befriending Mr. Jatir. Kartar Singh says, "We do not know when we may be released. We should be permitted to institute a case against him from the prison." Along with the printed books, he has destroyed manuscripts and notes for writing nearly 14 books. It is possible that when we are released, you may not be here, or one of us may not be here. It is also quite possible that this superintendent may be dead by that time. We want the case to be instituted against him now, or we may be permitted to inform the SGPC. They will do everything for us. The Inspector General says, "I am not prepared to hear anything against my superintendent." I tell him, "Then why did you come here, assuring us that you will listen to our complaints? You need not listen to us, nor to the superintendent. We will deal with him directly in the best way possible." On hearing this, the Inspector General went away. The next day, Dr. Jatir did not come. His brother, who was a commissioner, met a motor accident and his leg had to be amputated. Like Dr. Jatir, he also became lame. Dr. Jatir stayed for another month to look after his brother. Major L.H. Khan was sent back for a month to Jabalpur. He came back after that month. During his stay of another month, suddenly one day Dr. Jatir found our books and manuscripts locked up in an almari. On one of his rounds, he said to the jailer, "After all the books are found, we came to know about it." On the day he was to leave, he said, "Well, Ranthir Singh, check up on all your books." Then addressing the new superintendent, he said, "These books should be returned to them either when they are transferred to Punjab jail or when they are released." Thus, after the most cruel and inhumane treatment he accorded to us, Dr. Jatir was transferred to Jabalpur as the superintendent of that jail. Before he left, he misguided the new superintendent and asked him to treat us as harshly as possible. He, however, left strict orders that Bhai Kartar Singh and I should never be allowed to get together. He also left written orders that the books should be given to us only when we are released. Anyway, he did his utmost to harm us even while going. He then went to the UK for a while and became a major, but was again sent as jail superintendent to a place where many hefty Pathans and habitual offenders were imprisoned. Some of these Pathan prisoners under Dr. Jatir had earlier spent some years in Nagpur jail with us. They were eyewitnesses to the tyranny and tortures this man inflicted on us. As soon as he reached Jabalpur, the Pathans made up their mind to punish him for his misdeeds. Every Pathan made up his mind to teach him a lesson which he would never forget, and thus avenge the cruelty he perpetrated in Nagpur jail. Within a month of his arrival at Jabalpur, a hefty Pathan one day caught hold of him and gave him a good beating when he came on a round alone. He was made to suffer great humiliation. The Pathan was flogged for which he did not care, but Dr. Jatir got what he deserved. When during an inquiry, the Pathan was asked why did he beat and insult Dr. Jatir, the Pathan said, "This cruel man insulted and tortured one of our Sikh brothers, the well-known patriot and freedom fighter, Bhai Ranthir Singh. I have avenged his cruelty to the great patriot, but I am not satisfied with the punishment I have given him. He deserves more, and if I get an opportunity, I will beat and insult him again." This is what the fearless Pathan said, even after being severely flogged. The next week, another Pathan caught hold of him and gave him a good thrashing for flogging his Pathan comrade. After this incident, he became less arrogant, but not less mischievous. We learnt all this about him from the prisoners who came from Jabalpur to Nagpur. After this, we do not know what happened to him, and God alone knows what punishment awaits for him for his misdeeds after death. Even in Nagpur jail, 5 or 6 Sikh prisoners who had been imprisoned for the freedom to wear a kirpan were anxious to beat him, but prevented them from doing so. One Sikh and Pathan, however, made good their escape. The Sikh was later rearrested. I remember only 2 names out of these 6, Bhai Inder Singh and Bhai Pyara Singh. The seeds of evil, which he sowed would never dry up. The ill treatment continued. The second superintendent was transferred after a year. Then came to Nagpur a superintendent named Mr. Gupta. I do not remember his full name. He was very generous and noble. When he came, Bhai Kartar Singh and I were kept apart. The new superintendent treated us well and did not give us any trouble. He could not cancel the harsh orders already given, but he did not issue any new order, which was annoying to us. He was prepared to show leniency in many matters, but the jailer, a white man, would not permit him to do so. We were impressed by his generosity. He listened to our complaints with a cool mind. He was also very sympathetic towards us. I would like to mention one or two incidents of his generosity. One day, the jailer procured us a foul-smelling oil for applying to our hair. He charged for superior oil. After smelling it, I returned it to the jailer, saying that we want better oil. That oil could be returned. I had washed my hair with country soap. I could not comb my hair without applying oil, and I could not take my food till I had combed my hair. I made it quite clear to the jailer. Everyone knew about this principle of the six except the superintendent, Mr. Gupta. I washed my hair early in the morning, and then came noon. And then the evening, but no one brought the oil. They gave promises now and then, but no one brought it. So I did not take my meals for the whole day. The next day was Sunday, and the jailer, a white man, did not come on around. The superintendent generally did not come on Sundays. On the third day, the superintendent was busy in another octagon and did not come back to our block. No one thought of bringing oil for me. The superintendent was completely ignorant about it. On the fourth day, the jailer reported to the superintendent that I was on hunger strike for 4 days. The superintendent came to me with the whole staff. Mr. Gupta says, "Well, Ranthir Singh, ever since I have come here as superintendent, this is the first time anyone has tried to annoy me by hunger strike. You have not taken any meals for 4 days. Will that not fall as a curse on me?" I tell him, "Well, sir, I did not go on hunger strike consciously, nor are you to be blamed for anything. By chance, things took such a turn that I had to go without food. I had washed my hair with country soap, but I did not get any oil, without which they cannot be combed. If I knew that I would not be getting oil, I would not have washed my hair with the washing soap. With this soap, the hair becomes very dry, and it is not easy to comb them without applying some oil. The oil makes the hair smooth, and then, while combing, they do not break away or become entangled with one another. A Sikh is supposed to comb his hair twice daily, and without cleaning hair, he cannot take his meals. This is the strict religious order which I had to obey. As I did not get the oil promised to me, I did not take any meals. I did not go on hunger strike as a protest." On hearing this, the superintendent reprimanded the whole of his staff and asked them why they did not inform him about the matter. He immediately ordered that a bottle of good oil be brought. After half an hour, the superintendent personally brought the oil, and the following dialogue followed. "I am extremely sorry that unnecessary trouble has been caused to you," Mr. Gupta replied. "All this happened in my absence. I have great respect and feeling for your religious sentiments, and we should respect your religious sentiment with due consideration. But I am sorry there has been an inadvertent disregard for them. As long as I am here, this will not happen again." "I am extremely grateful to you," I reply. "The fact is that in the prison and outside, in all government offices, honesty and sincerity has disappeared. Selfishness and profiteering is the main motive. The storekeepers of the prison procure the cheapest things and charge the government the highest prices. No one cares to investigate the corruption prevalent in the prisons. Poor prisoners will never complain, and if they do, no one listens to it. We have had bitter experiences of such things. They profiteer even in small things. In this prison, there are hardly eight political Sikh prisoners. At the most, they require one bottle of coconut oil per month. But these people, to make profit even out of this. They bring the worst oil and charge government for the best. They rob the government and exploit the prisoners. Mr. Gupta listened to all I said and accepted what I said about the corrupt practices of the prison officials. He, however, assured that he would not let these things happen. While talking to me, he at once raised a question. Is it very essential to keep your hair on the head? I tell him, it is very essential to keep your hair. It is very essential to keep your head on your shoulders? Mr. Gupta says, the body cannot survive without the head. I tell him, but supposing the body survives after the head is cut off, would you cut off your head? Mr. Gupta says, the head is part of the body and a very prominent part of it. It is only the head that completes the body. Without the body cannot be what it is. I tell him, have you created the head on the body? He replies, no, God has created it and placed it on my shoulders. I tell him, because God has given you this head, therefore you feel it to be an essential part of your body. Had it been made by you and placed on your shoulders, you could conveniently take it off whenever you wish to do so. Yes, of course, Mr. Gupta replies, but we cannot remove what has been given to us by God. I tell him, supposing someone cuts off your God-given head, what would you call him? Murder, killer, slayer, he replies. If someone questions you why you have kept your head on your shoulders, what would you say? It would be very foolish of that person to put such a question, Mr. Gupta replies. I tell him, just as God has given us this head and made it part of our personality, so are the hair given by God and made part of our personality. As the hair is also given by God, the question you have posed, why is it essential to keep them, is not tenable. The question is out of place. I have not created these hairs myself. God gave them to me, and I have kept them. Just as God has given us the head, and we also keep it, so also are the hairs on our head has been given to us by God, and we keep it. So it is the duty of every man and woman to preserve and maintain them. You call a man who cuts off a person's head a murderer, a slayer, a killer. Would you not consider a man who removes his hair equally cruel? Is not one who destroys a God-given gift and an important part of her personality a bloodthirsty oppressor? I think he is. Mr. Gupta replies, you cannot call him a murderer. You call him by any other name. I tell him, why not a bloodthirsty murderer? Mr. Gupta says, because when you cut the hair, no blood comes out. I reply, so you think that when no blood comes out, and when someone destroys a part of her body, it is not cruelty, and least of all a murder? Supposing someone strangles a person, would you not call it a murder? No blood comes out, and the man is killed. I do not wish to prolong any discursive discussion, but you will admit that nowadays so many methods have been devised to kill a man that not a drop of his blood comes out. Would you not call these murderers, killers, and bloodthirsty slayers? What else would you call them? Mr. Gupta says, but sir, excuse me if I say that when you cut off the head of a person, you cannot replace it. But if you cut the hair off a person, they will grow again. A dead man never comes to life, but when we destroy living hair, new ones grow in its place. There is a good deal of difference between cutting one's head and cutting one's hair. Even if both are crimes, there is vast difference between the two crimes. I reply, do you believe in the transmigration theory? Yes, Mr. Gupta replies, I do believe in the transmigration theory. I reply, then according to that theory, you do not die even when your head is cut off. The soul, the Atma, is born again. So those who murder kill nothing. The soul is eternal. They relieve a person of one birth in a cycle of births. By doing so, they indirectly do good. But the man does not die after being killed. He will be born again and again. This is what actually happens. Yet, he who kills commits a futile act. He does not do good. So they who cut the hair again and again do no good, nor is there any virtue in it. the hair that is cut again and again, just as a man who is killed is born again and again. The only difference is that the soul may be born in different forms and may even be born as an animal. The hair of the head continues to grow when cut. Man foolishly cuts the hair and it grows again. That is how nature slaps the fool who goes against its requirement. Thus the attempt of a man to destroy his hair completely is as futile as to kill a man or an animal. The life and spirit of the Atma survives as long as the spirit and vital force of God is present in it. Similarly, the living essence of the hair will continue to be there as long as the body and head survive with the spirit of God. The hair of the body is to be preserved and kept clean, just as nature has created them. The hair of the head grow to be a natural length. Beyond a certain length, they do not grow. Those who put on artificial hair to bring them to a fashionable length to go against nature and do a foolish thing. Women do not grow any beard on their faces. If any woman wants, she cannot. Just as it is unnatural to try to develop beards on the faces of women, it is unnatural and wrong to destroy the natural hair that grows on a man's head. Men naturally grow beards on their faces, but the fashionable people shave it every morning. Every morning, nature slaps them in the face by resisting their attempt to remove the beard, but they are unconscious of it. They want to make their faces look exactly like those of women. Men have gone against nature by shaving their beard and appearing like women and gain nothing. Unfortunately, women have started cutting short the hair of their head like men in order to look like men. They too have gained nothing. I think it is utter shamelessness for men to try to imitate women and for women to imitate men. The real question should be, why is this God-given gift, the natural hair and beard, be removed? But those who do so against the wishes of nature start questioning the other way around. The unfortunate thing is that the majority of people are shaving these days, and this sheep-like imitation and fashion to remove the hair and beard is deemed as the natural law. There are very few who obey the essential laws of nature and in this connection. Apart from the six, there are very few who keep their hair and beard. Those who spoil their manly appearance and personality given by nature are unconscious of their own folly in distorting their appearance, but they are shocked to see a man keeping hair and beard and do not hesitate to ask them, "Is it essential to keep the hair and beard?" They suddenly become unconscious of the fact that hair is a part of the whole body and grows on every pore of the body. Those who are pure in body, mind, and soul, and those who know something about sciences, know that to remove bodily hair from the whole of our body is a crime against health. You have taken up discussion on a subject on which many articles and even a book can be written. Neither you have time to enter such a long discussion, nor am I free to do so. Such discursive discussions and questions are generally raised by Arya Samajis. "Have you at any time fallen under their evil influence?" Mr. Gupta laughing replies, "I am not that type of Hindu. The staunch Arya Samajis are. Nor do I believe in any discursive discussion. I was attracted a bit towards Arya Samaj. I put the question out of curiosity and not with the intention of debating about it in an injurious way. I really wanted to know something about it. Although you have used some strong words in your discussion, yet your arguments have impressed me. Many of my doubts have been cleared. I hope when you are released, you will write an excellent book on the subject and get it translated in other languages to explain it in the world to the world at large. Your argument of fashionable and sheep-like imitation is correct. Our rishis, munis, avatars, and prophets used to keep their hair and beard. We have clear-cut evidence up to the period of Mahabharata, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Peshwas in our ancient history who kept their hair and beard. God alone knows why, when did the custom of shaving begin in India. From the Mahabharata and other Indian literature of the period, we learn that removal of the hair or beard was considered worse punishment than death. when Sri Krishna, on the recommendation of his spouse Rukmani, reduced the death sentence of her brother Rukman to the punishment of removing his hair and beard, Rukman, in a pitiable tone, appealed to his sister, saying, "O Rukmani, you are not my sister, you are my enemy. You have got my death sentence repealed, and got for me a greater punishment of removing my hair and beard. To remove my hair and beard would be far more painful and torturous than killing me. Your ideas are indeed very enlightened, and you are indeed a true Sikh, living according to the highest principles of your faith. No one has ever given so convincing reply to my question. For a seeker, even one good argument is enough. Now a good deal of time has elapsed. My namaste to you. We will meet again." I greeted him. "Again, we may never get a chance to discuss anything." I said, "Mr. Gupta was indeed a very noble soul. We never got a chance to hold discussion again." One day, I was standing self-absorbed in my cell, leaning against the prison bars. Incidentally, Mr. Gupta came there with his staff on a round and stood near me. On hearing some noise, I turned to him. He looked into my eyes and asked, "Why are your eyes a little swollen and red? Did you not get sleep at night?" "So much the better," I said. "The whole life has passed by in sleep. By the grace of the Lord, I was deprived of palatial mansions, soft cushions and beds, and locked up in this Nagpur jail, the veritable abode of the Nagas, the snakes, where the mosquitoes keep me awake in the sweet remembrance of God. But for this, my mind might have been idle and dozed away in luxury and forgotten God." On hearing these words, the tender-hearted superintendent, Mr. Gupta, quietly went away, and after writing something on my history ticket, carried it with him. The next day, I received an excellent mosquito net. The head warder was ordered to have it fixed on my bed every night. I felt that changes were taking place, by the grace of the Lord, for better days ahead. In deep gratitude of my God and Guru, I began to pass my days in peaceful meditation. The comfortable relief given from the mosquitoes by the mosquito net gave me added opportunity to meditate without the least disturbance. The mosquitoes not only kept me awake, but even disturbed the deep concentration of mind. Now I could meditate in comfortable peace. It was my duty to use these restful nights for a better purpose. While meditating in mosquito net, I could see everyone outside, but no one could see me. So now, in the secrecy of my rest in the mosquito net, I could meditate without being watched. I could reap the fruit of meditation in full. There is a Punjabi saying that God has given plenty of radish and also a knife to cut and eat. This is exactly how I felt. In the daytime, a man came and took off the mosquito net. The mosquitoes of Nagpur are terrible, but this mosquito net remained with me till the end of my stay in Nagpur. For 6 or 7 years, we had to endure the terrible biting of the mosquitoes to such an extent that we had almost become mosquito-proof. After experiencing and enduring the biting of Nagpur mosquitoes, I feel the Punjabi mosquitoes are comparatively quite harmless. Those few days passed in peace. I now leave aside the story of my life in Nagpur jail. If I remember any incident later on, it can be included in the second edition. But there is one incident worth mentioning before I close. It was a completely dark cell in which I had to spend day and night in Japa Jap. In the wonderful celestial music of which I remained absorbed most of the time, I could feel and see with my inner eyes the close presence of my Guru and God. The ever-refreshing bliss of His presence and revelations spread from the fragrant navel seat of inner consciousness to the lotus of the heart, and higher still to the superconscious states where the music of His divine name became a light and vision of an eternal splendor. The whole of my inner being was ablaze with His light, and that light was spread and lighted the whole space of my inner and outer being. Just as the rays of the sun pervade all, so the light of God can be blended with everything. This is how I felt and experienced. The light of God that can be visibly seen is in essence really spread like the light of the sun. my inner vision felt blessed and exalted by the bliss of the vision in which I saw the Beloved so near and in a form so clear. One day, I was standing close to the bars of my cell, when my mind soared and fell into a state of samadhi, in a blissful state. I do not know how long I stood there, but I kept standing, even when the hot sun blazed and its burning light fell on my body from the courtyard. Even then, I stood there unconscious of the heat. I stood in this condition till someone shook me by the shoulder, and my eyes that were closed in deep concentration of nectar-laved vision suddenly opened. I opened my eyes and for a moment saw nothing around me. I stood there in a trance, looking fixed into the unseen. Then from the outside bars I heard a voice saying, "Excuse me, I had to disturb you. For over 15 minutes we have been standing here in the cell yard. A Christian missionary who has just come from England has been waiting here for some time, along with the prison officials. The Padre Sahib has specially come to meet you." I saw the Christian missionary standing in the outer corridor under the shade of the wall, and addressing him said, "Please come inside. Why do you keep standing at such a distance? Are you all right?" questioned the Christian missionary. "Why not come closer and ask me how I am?" "Why keep standing at such a distance?" said I. Actually, the inner corridor was blazing under the hot sun, while he was standing in the shade of the walls in the outer corridor. He did not find courage to come and stand in the burning sun. The superintendent realized his difficulty. He opened the lock of my cell and took me out close to him in the shade. I laughed heartily and said to the missionary, "How is it that you could not endure the heat of the sun, which we have been enduring for so many years?" He looked at my face, and then addressing the officials and other visitors, he said, "His face is radiant and resplendent. I have seen innumerable political prisoners, but his face is unique." Then addressing me, he asked, "Are you happy? Are you well?" "The Lord is gracious," I said. The superintendent told him that I understood English quite well, but I said I prefer to speak in my mother tongue, Punjabi. He sometimes spoke in English, and sometimes in Hindustani, but I gave replies in Punjabi, which he understood. The Christian missionary said, "For how long have you been kept in this dark cell?" I tell him, "Ever since I was brought to Nagpur jail, I have been kept mostly in this cell. I might have spent about 5 or 6 months in solitary confinement in other cells." The Christian missionary says, "How many years of imprisonment have you spent in this jail?" "My history ticket will tell you that," I said. After examining the history ticket, which the superintendent gave him, he replies, "So you have come here towards the end of the year 1922. You have been kept here for nearly 8 years. How many hours a day in the daytime are you kept in this dark cell?" "I am made to spend the whole day and night in this cell," I tell him. "For how many hours are you taken for a walk?" the Christian missionary replies. "For how long are you allowed to take exercise?" "Not even for a single hour," I reply. "All that I can do is to come out of the cell in the courtyard attached to it, where I can cook and eat my food, or take a bath, or ease nature. Immediately after that, I am again locked in the cell." Looking angrily at the prison officials, "Why is he treated like that?" the missionary replies. The jailer says, "The Punjab government has given strict orders not to allow him to meet his comrades or any other prisoner. We have orders to keep him apart from everyone. Even prison officials dare not meet him alone. We have no obligation to taking him outside, but we have strict orders from above not to do so." Addressing me, the Christian missionary asked, "Do you get any newspaper for reading?" "Never," I tell him, although the Inspector General of Prison has permitted it. The Christian missionary, in addressing the prison officials, says, "When the Inspector General has given permission, why do they not give the newspaper?" There's some confidential reason for it," the superintendent replies. The Christian missionary, in addressing me, says, "Do they give you some books to read?" "No, never," I tell him. "They have even confiscated our prayer books, which belong to us. My history ticket will show you that." Do you sleep in the corridor or in the cell at night? The missionary replies. Please ask them, I tell him, laughing. The superintendent and others, with one voice, asked, no political or other prisoner is allowed to sleep in the corridor. Do you stay alone in this cell? The missionary says. No, never. I am never alone, even for a single minute. The superintendent and jailer, excited, asked, what he has stated is a lie. He is alone in the cell. There's no one. I tell him, both of them are telling a lie. I'm never alone in the cell, nor have I ever been alone in the cell for a single day. The Christian missionary, addressing them, asks, well, sirs, what is the meaning of this? Why do you insist on saying that he stays alone when he says he is never alone? Sir, the superintendent says, according to prison rules, we cannot keep more than one prisoner in any one cell. We have strict orders never to lodge two prisoners in one cell. We can show you the jail regulations. We are telling the truth, and he is making a false statement. Seriously, I tell him. I am telling the truth. They are wrong. We, Sikhs of the Guru, can never tell a lie. The Christian missionary said, how can this enigma be solved? Responsible prison officials are making a statement which cannot be called false, but my conscience tells me that this Sikh is also telling the truth. A prisoner, in this his position, who is not given any books, nor given any newspapers, nor is allowed to talk to anyone, and is lodged in this dark cell day and night, cannot survive and live without such a beaming face as his. Look at his face. How glowing and refreshing it is. There is not a trace of gloom on his face, but it is red with glowing radiance. After being locked up day and night for so many years, I cannot imagine such beaming radiance and fragrance on any human face. So I cannot believe that he is making a false statement. After all, how can we solve this enigma? After a silence of a few minutes, addressing me, he says, I cannot doubt the statement of the responsible officials to be false. I also cannot believe that you are making a false statement. Please solve this mystery. If you are not staying alone, then who lives with you all the time? On hearing this, my mind soared high, and in a voice filled with deep mystic fervor, and under a musical inspiration, suddenly leaping from the unknown, I sang the following divine song in answer to the question. The Guru is with me ever and ever, contemplating him, I live in his presence. I contemplate ever the name of God within my heart. All comrades and companions are thereby saved. The Lord, the Guru, is with me ever and ever, contemplating him, I live in his presence. Thy will is ever sweet to me, Lord. Nanak seeks only the word of God, says Guru Arjan in Rag Asa. Everyone was thrilled by the divine song. Like statues, all stood motionless and felt the magnetic effect influence of the divine song. The refrain became the burden of the song. For many minutes, the whole atmosphere was charged with the spiritual influence of the song. Everyone stood silently with fixed attention. No one spoke. No one moved. Everyone felt the bliss of the song. The Christian missionary, who understood every word of it, was the first to speak and break the silence. He said, the mystery has been well solved indeed. So your Guru is ever with you. So you were indeed telling the truth, and in a way, the prison officials were also telling the truth. But I wish to test your statement a little more. In addressing the prison officials, he asks, who stays in the adjoining cells? Please call them. The jailer said, well, sir, in the daytime they remain empty, and night, different prisoners are lodged in these cells. Why do you lock them up at night? The Christian missionary asks. Who are locked up in here? Some special prisoners under the orders of solitary confinement, or you pick them at random and lock them up here. No, sir, the jailer says. These prisoners, who have been ordered by the magistrate to be kept in solitary confinement, alone are kept locked up day and night in these cells. The Christian missionary replies, what is the maximum period for which a prisoner can be kept in solitary confinement? Could you quote the regulation of penal code? For a month at the most, the jailer replies. To this, the missionary says, is there any prisoner who is kept in this cell only at night, but is allowed to move about outside in the daytime? No, the jailer replies, there is no such prisoner, sir. The missionary says, but you say two prisoners are always locked up at night in the adjoining cells. Why is it that punishment is given to them? The jailer says, well, sir, they are not kept here because they are punished for something, but according to prison rules, we cannot keep these cells vacant. So we asked other prisoners to spend one night in them, turn by turn. So one prisoner is kept by turn in each of these two cells. The missionary says, why do you change the prisoner every night? Why can you not keep the same prisoner for some nights in the cell? The jailer replies, we cannot compel any prisoners to be locked up in this cell every night. For one night or so, they gladly agree to be locked up in them. I tell him, no one is gladly willing to spend a night in these dark cells. Would it not be better to ask those who have already spent a night here, whether they would be willing to spend a night in these cells again? The Christian missionary then examined the logbook and found that no prisoner had stayed in those cells more than one night. He had ordered five or six of these prisoners to be brought, who had spent the night in these cells during the preceding week. He asked every one of those prisoners how they felt during that night in that dark cell, and why do they not volunteer to stay again for another night in it. Everyone with one voice said, sir, God save us from this dungeon. Even to pass one night has been great torture. The terrible loneliness and gloom is unbearable. After inquiring everything about their experience in those dark cells from the prisoners, the Christian missionary made up his mind to spend one night in one of the cells as a matter of experiment. So he expressed his strong wish to spend one night in the cell. The superintendent and others tell him, sir, how can we do that without the orders of the government? The missionary says, I would be getting locked up in one of these cells for a night voluntarily and gladly for the sake of experiencing how a man feels. When the prison officials found him adamant in his determination to carry out the experiment, they agreed to lock him up in the daytime, but not in the night, and even that for a few hours only. The Christian missionary agreed to be locked up for at least 3 hours. The prison officials were, however, seriously upset. Why do you worry? I said to them. The Padre Sahib will not be able to stay in the cell for more than an hour. Let him experiment. What do you lose by it? You have to spend no money on it. Of course, said the Christian missionary. I just want to experience it myself, how one feels. So the Christian missionary was ready to be locked up in the dark cell. I humorously said to him, how fine it would have been if you put on the dress of the prisoners and get into it. But the prison officials would not permit you to do so. So it soon decided that the Padre Sahib would be locked in this third cell adjoining mine, and would be kept in at least for 3 hours. Just as he was about to enter the cell, I whispered into his ears, well, sir, there's a chain dangling in the cell. It is connected with a bell outside. If you find any difficulty in staying long, please pull that chain. The warder in charge would at once open the door. He thanked me for this information and entered the cell where he was locked up. I was also locked up in my cell. All the prison officials, the warders, and the sentries got away, and officers went and sat in the office of the warder in charge of the octagon. Within an hour, the bell of Padre Sahib's cell began to ring as loudly as a fire alarm. The octagon in charge warder came running. The Christian missionary was shouting from inside, open the door quickly. Take me out quickly. I'm dying. The door was opened. The Christian missionary came out, and after breathing open air for some time, he said, take that Sikh of Guru Nanak out of the cell and bring him here. I was taken out and brought before the Christian missionary, who placed his hands on my shoulders and said repeatedly, well, noble Sikh, your master, Guru Nanak, is indeed ever with you. But my master, Lord Jesus, does not abide with me in the dark dungeon as your Guru Nanak does. I am now convinced that your Lord, Guru Nanak, must be visibly living with you. Please repeat that song you sang. I sang that song under renewed inspiration, and while I sang, my face flushed with rapturous joy of its inner experience. After hearing it, the Christian missionary said, I now realize the true significance of the words of the song. It is quite true that your Guru resides in your heart and soul, nay, in your whole inner being, and you never feel lonely. I have seen it from experience that apart from other difficulties, the gloomy torture of loneliness is the greatest difficulty to be encountered. Oppressing loneliness was the only difficulty I encountered. Every moment I felt the dissolution and dreariness gnawing at my heart. Blessed art thou, O noble Sikh of the Guru, who spent years in this dungeon all alone. Nay, I make a mistake again, not alone, but with the unusual spiritual powers you have acquired from your Guru. You appear to see the blazing light of the Guru ever burning in your heart. You must be in constant communion with your great Guru, and you must be experiencing his nearness and discoursing with him every moment. That is why you neither feel loneliness, nor are you ever upset. Nor is there any evil effect on your body. I was almost dying from dreary and dark loneliness. Great and glorious you are, noble Sikh, and great and glorious is your Guru. After saying this, he went away along with his party. When he reached the prison gate, he asked for the prison logbook and wrote 3 pages of his impressions of the prison. The sympathetic officers who read it reported to me that he gave a vivid portrayal of what was happening in the prison. He particularly mentioned that the cruelty perpetrated and the tortures inflicted on me were unprecedented. He wrote many things in my favor. A few sympathizers even promised to procure a copy of his report, but they did not get an opportunity to do so. After recording his complaint in the logbook, he went straight to the governor of Central Province and met him about this matter. I do not know what he said to the governor, but after 3 days, I was suddenly taken to an open barrack where there was a hand pump close by and a large open air courtyard. There was sufficient ground to take a walk, and mosquito net was also given to me. The whole barrack was at my disposal. I was also informed that my friend Bhai Kartar Singh would be allowed to stay near me soon enough. But even before this happened, the Punjab government sent a telegram to send me to Punjab immediately. As soon as the telegram reached the office, I began to receive congratulations, and the date for my departure was fixed. The superintendent and the jailer informed me that it was not mere transfer orders, but a step to release me soon. I was assured that I would be released as soon as I reached Punjab. They also informed me they would be sending 1 or 2 spies with me, and I would travel without being handcuffed. I requested them to send Bhai Kartar Singh to me so before I left we could stay together. The superintendent promised, but the jailer did not agree. However, he said, if you were not to leave, we would have certainly brought you together. The jailer feared that Bhai Kartar Singh might inform me of the tortures inflicted on him secretly, and the matter may go out to the public when I was released. But the superintendent took courage to permit us to be together at least for a day or two. So we were allowed to meet for a day. Living in the same prison, we met there for the first time after 3 years or so. We embraced each other, told each other what we had experienced and how we had suffered. Many secret feelings and thoughts were exchanged. After meeting for the whole day, we were again separated at night. All the books that were confiscated were returned. All the things that were taken from my personal possession on the day I was arrested were returned. These things included my clothes, a rosary, a kirpan, a chakar, iron bangles. A very precious kirpan, which I generally wore with a strap, was not returned. God alone knows where it was lost. They searched for it, but could not get it. They were, however, prepared to pay for it. When they lost all hope of finding it, I told them that the kirpan was priceless. It was not possible for them to pay the price. If I had demanded any amount, they would have paid it. But I did not feel like taking any money for the kirpan, which for me was a religious symbol. What could I get for some money?